This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. On June 13th, House Democrats chanted complaints and even walked out during House Speaker Paul Ryan's moment of silence for Pulse victims. Connecticut Representative Jim Himes went as far as calling such symbolic gestures, quote, obnoxious expressions of smug incompetence. Last week, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy held the floor for a 15-hour filibuster about gun control measures. And this week, close to 30 House Democrats staged a sit-in arguing for the same thing. Will the divisive debate over gun legislation be a defining point in the coming state, congressional and presidential races? But first, Marco Rubio announcing Wednesday he'll seek re-election in the Senate. He's already leading his opponents in one poll just days after announcing his candidacy. What does this mean for his political future, and how did the tragedy in his home state factor into his decision to run? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Well, joining me in the studio, Jason Garcia, Associate Editor with Florida Trend Magazine, and Maria Padilla, Editor of OrlandoLatino.org, and with us by phone, Daryl Owens, Head of Communications with Beacon College, also columnist for FloridaPolitics.com. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can weigh in too. What are your thoughts on the follow-up from Pulse? Are you overwhelmed by the outpouring of support, monetary support and otherwise, millions of dollars raised for the One Orlando Fund alone? Are you concerned about fraud in the wake of this tragedy? How safe do you feel going about your business in the City Beautiful? What does the city and county need to do now to support those businesses that were closed for a week around Pulse? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Let's talk a little bit about the politics first of this, though. And as a sidebar, Florida's once and future Senator Marco Rubio is running again for Senate. But for weeks, months even, he was saying something completely different to the media.
No, I'm not running for re-election to the Senate. As I said, I'm going to finish my term here and then I'll be a private citizen.
That was Marco Rubio in March. Right after he lost the Florida presidential primary on Wednesday this week, he said he changed his mind. What do you think of the 180? Are you ready for six more years of Rubio? Are you looking for a new face like Carlos Baruff, for example? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Jason Garcia, let me start with you. Are we seeing kind of a long game here from Rubio? I mean, there's a talk that it sets him up maybe better for a presidential run in 2020, if that's what he's interested in.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what this is about. The two choices he faced were either you go to the private sector and make some money and try and run as someone with private sector experience, or you go back to the Senate and you've got a national platform to be involved in national debates. And I think he concluded that there was a bigger risk to leaving the stage and being absent for 4 years than there was from being in the Senate and being involved that way. So I think I believe the overwhelming sort of focus of this decision was this was a better platform to run for president in 4 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Rubio might have learned from the primary process that could see a different Rubio in the Senate next term, maybe a different campaign if and when he seeks a higher office?
Well, one thing I suspect he's probably learned is he's not going to take the lead on immigration reform again. A lot of sort of how he will be as a senator will be sort of impacted by who the president is. But I think you will see him taking up getting more aggressive in issues important to the Republican base.
Maria Padilla, what are your thoughts here? I mean, let's talk a little bit about Rubio 2.0. Do you see him being a different senator from the pre-presidential primary campaign, Rubio? We've seen a lot more of Senator Rubio in Florida.
Yes.
Out doing senatorial business.
Senatorial stuff.
In the last few months.
Yes, that's true. Well, I, for one, and I'm sure many people are waiting to see which Rubio shows up for the re-election campaign. Will it be the Rubio that was initially gained office and was the pro-immigration reform Rubio, reaching across the aisle and all that? Or is it going to be the presidential primary Rubio who went much farther to the left, I'm sorry, to the right, mm-hmm. in order to attract that GOP base? So I'm not quite sure. But as you say, we have seen a different kind of Rubio in the last couple of weeks showing up for work, voting, whether you agree with him or not, and acting a lot more senatorial, or at least as if he enjoys the job.
There's a question of timing here, too. How much of a factor do you think this post-nightclub shooting and the focus on national security and terrorism might have been in pushing him towards this decision?
Well, I think the Pulse shooting has a double-edged sword for Rubio because, first of all, Rubio is has proclaimed himself and has talked many, many, many times of being for traditional marriage. He is anti-same-sex marriage, and he said that many, many times, including on the primary trail. On the other hand, the Pulse shooting also picks up a particular favorite topic of his, which is the whole subject of national security, domestic terrorism, fight against ISIS, and so on and so forth. So my guess is that that is where he's going to lean, not necessarily on the same sex or civil rights of LGBT community.
Darrell Owens, let me bring you on the conversation. Rubio copped quite a bit of flack from his opponents in the presidential primary about being a vote misser. How much of that can voters forget come November, or you know, in the GOP primary a little bit closer?
Well, if the new poll that you referenced earlier from Quinnipiac is any gauge, Matthew, it seems that voters are willing to forgive and forget. As you know, the poll finds Rubio leads Democrats Patrick Murphy by 7 points and Alan Grayson by 8 points. And political handicappers see him making short work of his GOP challengers. So apparently Floridians may be willing to give the former erstwhile senator a pass on missing votes in pursuit of the golden political ticket.
There's still Carlos Baruff in the wings, though. He's saying Rubio is the establishment candidate that Washington doesn't need. I'm wondering, Darrell, do you see the outsider effect that's seen a candidate like Donald Trump rise in the presidential primary? Does that factor in here, too, and could that give Carlos Baruff some momentum?
In Florida, not so much. That same poll shows that Floridians may not be particularly smitten with the outsider charm at the top of the GOP ticket, as the survey shows Hillary Clinton smoking the presumptive Republican presidential candidate by 8 points.
Jason Garcia, tease apart the Trump factor here for a moment, if you could. I mean, it looks like Rubio, in saying he'll run, is also going back a little bit, walking back, saying he'll speak on behalf of Trump at the convention. What's he doing here? How many more twists are we in for?
Well, this is something that Republican candidates across the country are going to be dealing with this year, is sort of how do you sort of, you know, sort of hang with a Republican nominee that you are supporting, but that wide swaths of the electorate don't like. So you're going to see a lot of people sort of twisting around this, where they support Trump but also publicly chastising him and almost seeming to run against him at different points. And I just want to sort of back up to one thing. You started to touch on it. I think for all the attention on the general election here, I think Marco Rubio's got a real challenge in the Republican primary, particularly if Carlos Baruff spends his money. Mm-hmm. People sort of overlook the fact that in the presidential primary, 3 out of 4 Republican voters picked someone other than Marco Rubio for president. And Donald Trump got nearly 50% of the vote. And there's becoming a very, very real divide in sort of Florida Republicans between sort of the Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio wing and the Rick Scott, Donald Trump, Carlos Baruff type wing.
Right.
And if Carlos Baruff can effectively claim that mantle of a true outsider, a Donald Trump like candidate, I think that's a real challenge for Marco Rubio. And he's going to Rubio is now going to be saddled with the career politician line, which is not something that he's really sort of found himself in a one-on race with that dynamic before. Mm-hmm. That primary, provided Carlos Baruff is willing to put his money into it, is going to be very interesting.
Maria, I see you nodding your head there.
Yes, because Carlos Baruff has already stated that he has $15 million that he's ready to plunk down on this race. And Rubio may very well win that August primary, but he may come out of there limping, as Jason is implying, which makes him a slightly weaker candidate going into the general election.
Mm-hmm. I want to just come back to the kind of divide you're talking about there, Jason. According to the Miami Herald, Rick Scott is encouraging Baruff to stay in the race. How do you explain this? Because, you know, Rick Scott's lieutenant governor, Carlos Lopez Cantera, is backing Marco Rubio. So it just seems a little bit complex, the sort of different factions pitting against each other here. What is Rick Scott playing at?
Right. Well, the first thing to understand about that is the lieutenant governor position is useless, and there's not really any sort of reason for that or anything to read into relationships behind that. The lieutenant governor tends to be someone who's picked who's sort of available to take the job, and maybe there's some sort of political sort of niche they can fill, but there's not usually or very often there's not a real alliance there or anything. So a divide between Rick Scott and his lieutenant governor over who they're backing is sort of not surprising. But generally, Rick Scott has made it sort of very clear his political brand is someone who is completely unbeholden to the sort of existing power structure, Republican or Democrat. And he is he was the most prominent Florida Republican who refused to endorse Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio during the presidential primary back when they were viable candidates. And in fact, he sort of stayed with Trump. He never formally endorsed Trump, but he sort of made it very clear Trump was where he was leaning for a while leading up to that primary, when that was still a somewhat political risky thing to do. Rick Scott represents that sort of Donald Trump wing of the party of people who are angry and fed up with politicians who have been the system as it is. So that divide is real. And Rick Scott, I mean, for him to back Carlos Baruff over Marco Rubio, you know, setting aside the fact that he and Carlos Baruff have personal relationships, Rick Scott has put him on all sorts of boards. He's a guy he relies on. It makes all the political sense in the world for Rick Scott to go in that direction rather than Marco Rubio.
Maria, let me just come back to something you were touching on before. Is Marco Rubio overestimating how much voter support he might have, and especially if he's kind of, using the polls as kind of a motivating factor to get back in the race, saying national security is the thing that he's going to focus on, you know, particularly when you look at his past history, things he said on the campaign trail as a presidential primary candidate?
Correct. I think there's a possibility of that, because going back to the presidential primary, he overestimated the support he was going to get from fellow Floridians who were, to some extent, fed up with his presidential run and the fact that he was not really tending to issues that were important to Florida. Whether he is doing that again remains to be seen. We'll find out. But there is a distinct possibility there because, as you mentioned earlier, voting for Marco Rubio, voters know going into the voting booth that he's essentially going to run for president again.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we don't know.
Time will tell, I guess. Some crystal ball gazing might be in order, but in this political climate, it's kind of hard to predict. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We are with Daryl Owens, Jason Garcia, Maria Padilla, talking about the Pulse aftermath, fundraising, politics, gun control, the congressional sit-in, and more. We're at 1-866-338-5252 locally in Orlando. The money's flowing into the city of Orlando for victims of the Pulse shooting. Thousands of people have come out to show their support at vigils, memorials. The questions are mounting, too, about the police handling of the crisis, how scrutiny on the city as it figures out how to go best distribute the money going forward. Later in the show, too, we'll talk about a hiatus on the bear hunt for this year. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Wineries, with 22 farm wineries throughout the state. Tasting, tours, and day trips showcase the history of winemaking. Many local supermarkets feature Florida wines. More information at tryfloridawine.com.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Good Friday morning. I'm Nicole Creston. Thanks for joining us. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices.
Support for 90.7 News comes from the Iron Yard Academy, offering 12-week immersive coding courses designed to help launch careers in technology. Classes currently enrolling in Orlando. More information about learning to code is at theironyard.com/Orlando. The Iron Yard Academy. Life's too short for the wrong career.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Well, looking beyond Orlando and the after effects of the Pulse nightclub shooting, ripples from the tragedy have spread to Washington, D.C. This week, congressional Democrats carried out a sit-in trying to force the GOP's hand on gun control bills. The proposed bills would bar suspected terrorists on no-fly lists from buying guns and impose universal background checks. It was streamed live on Periscope, other social media platforms. Republican representatives went home. House Leader Paul Ryan said he has no intention of calling a vote on these bills, but the sit-in participants claimed a victory anyhow. Here's Representative John Lewis introducing the sit-in.
Those who pursue common sense improvement are beaten down. Reason is criticized. Obstruction is praised. Newtown, Grover, Charleston, Orlando. What is the tipping point? Are we blind? Can we see?
Well, that was Representative John Lewis talking at that sit-in up in the Capitol Hill there. Questions, though, about what's going on with that sit-in, what the effect will be, and in fact, once they come back from their July 4th break, or what is going to happen there? Let's listen to Central Florida Representative Alan Grayson now.
There are now seven states that have adopted either bans or heavy restrictions on assault weapons. I think that this state needs to do that. I think that all America needs to return to the assault weapons ban that we had from 1994 to 2004, which reduced mass shootings committed by assault weapons by two-thirds.
That's Alan Grayson there. Was this a stunt, as House Speaker Paul Ryan said? Could it get something going on gun control measures? Are the two sides too firmly entrenched on the issue? Was the Pulse nightclub shooting a turning point? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can join the conversation. Also joined in the studio by Maria Padilla and Jason Garcia. On the phone, Daryl Owens. You can weigh in as well, 1-866-338-5252. Well, let me turn to you, Daryl Owens. You wrote a column for FloridaPolitics.com taking a look at how you kind of processed this tragedy yourself. I wonder if you could just kind of elaborate and tell us what you wrote about there.
Well, essentially what I wrote about was how after I got word of the poll shooting, I had this initial blasé response. The first alert I saw noted about 20 people had been killed in the shooting, and while I thought that was terrible, it didn't really give me much pause. It was only after the death toll was scaled up to 50 did it stop me in my tracks, both because of the body count, but also because I had been so nonchalant about it before. And in writing the column, I realized that the two regular rash of mass shootings in America, shootings that I had often written about and eulogized the victims over, had put me on the road to becoming desensitized, and it unnerved me.
Do you think the shooting, Daryl Owens, marks a turning point? I mean, could you see something coming out of the sit-ins we've seen up in Capitol Hill, or maybe at the local level, at Florida at least? Could you see some legislation coming out of this?
I would like to think so, Matthew, but I presume there would be a turning point after Sandy Hook, and I presume there'd be a turning point after Charleston, and I presume there'd be a turning point after San Bernardino, and after Aurora, and after Virginia Tech, and so on.
Maria Padilla, the shooting affected so many in the LGBT and the Latino communities. Do you see that having an impact as far as motivating those communities to get out, organize, demand change on gun control, if that's what the key issue is going to be going forward?
I think there's always the possibility that some sort of synergism will be generated or created. I frankly have not actually seen it just yet on this particular issue. Doesn't mean it may not emerge, but I haven't seen them. I think people are still very much heavily focused on getting the victims buried, reaching out to the families, making sure that they're taken care of, and so forth. So I don't know that they've had much time to really think about that.
What are folks in the Latino community looking for as far as political leadership here, and which leaders are they reaching out to?
On the national level, I was looking for which Latinos that I know of in the community that I'm familiar with were on the House floor. And there is no definitive list. I was looking all over the internet yesterday. There's no definitive list who was actually there. You have to go by the photos that you see. I did not see the people that I would expect to see. In the Puerto Rican community, for instance, you would look to people like Luis Gutierrez, Democrat from Illinois, or Nidia Velasquez, Democrat from New York, or Jose Serrano, also Democrat from New York. I didn't see them there. I don't know why they weren't there. They could have been doing something else. So on a national level, these would be the people who would probably take that up.
Mm-hmm. Jason Garcia, how do you see that sit-in playing out? Are we going to see something get going with a conversation, some bipartisan legislation maybe, or is this standoff going to continue?
Well, Daryl made this point, but it's hard for me to see this marking a changing point. If Sandy Hook didn't change things, I don't think Pulse will change things in sort of the national dialogue. The key to sort of advancing this debate in any way or resolving it is probably going to be nationalizing the issue and making it a centerpiece issue both in the presidential race and in U.S. Senate races. Congressional races, for the most part, are too gerrymandered for it to be anything other than completely polarizing. But in U.S. Senate races where candidates are running across the whole state, if you can make that a signature issue, you could finally maybe see some clarity. Although historically, Democrats in those types of races, those non-gerrymandered races, have shied away from gun control as an issue mm-hmm. because they've tend to lose on it. So the short answer is it's hard for me to see much happening out of this, but the thing to watch will be whether or not this becomes a major central issue in some of these big U.S. Senate races.
One thing you also see is people talking about candidates and elected officials' NRA ratings. I mean, that's kind of a talking point, right?
That's right. Time. Traditionally, or at least for the last 20 years at least, guns have been an issue that have favored Republicans. They have been It is an issue that they have won on politically. And these mass shootings have not changed the dynamic so far. At some point, is there sort of a tipping point where enough people sort of turn on that? I don't know. The NRA is a very influential lobby, and its members are incredibly passionate. You know, this is the issue they vote on in a lot of cases, and for most voters, there isn't one single issue. This is sort of like abortion for some pro-life and pro-choice folks. It's a single-issue thing. Mm-hmm. Guns are like that generally for pro-gun people. It is less likely to be the single-issue driving gun control people.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the Pulse aftermath, some of the political fallout and follow-up from that. We're at 1-866-338-5252. I'm going to take a call now. We've got Thron Crow from Orlando. Thron, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking me. Appreciate it.
Sure.
My wife Lolly and I are just getting back from putting to rest our cousin, her raised as a brother, Luis Daniel Wilson Leon. He was shot, him and his partner were shot and killed at Pulse, and we haven't stopped since that last Sunday. Mm-hmm. It's very hard, but we've had time to reflect. I think it's been discussed that there's still a lot of everybody's still a little shot, but what we can say is that the support has been unparalleled. I mean, it's been being on the receiving end of everything from the state to private. Everyone has done so much to help. It really means a lot more than I can represent. But I can say that it's difficult to have to continue to see personal social feeds, all the stories and arguments and opinions, and we never thought we would be in the middle of this, but I can say that we're going to have difficulties with friends regarding rights. We're going to have difficulties with friends regarding LGBT rights, but we will be taking a stand in our own way, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to, it's so difficult, but yeah, it's very raw, but and I agree with your panel that I think it's going to be difficult to see any kind of legislation move forward, and I feel the same way about the previous shootings. What's going to be different about this one to make any legislation occur? I don't know if it will, but I can guarantee you that it will not back down. It will only get stronger, and if this continues to happen, I think
Thron, I'm going to have to jump in there. Your phone's breaking up, but I do appreciate the call. I'm so sorry for your loss, and thanks for taking the time to call. And let me just bring that back to you, Maria Padilla. Sounds like there's a lot of passion there, at least from this caller now, Thron Crow, calling in, saying he just went to the funeral of one of his friends out in Puerto Rico, friends killed in the Pulse nightclub shooting. Does that passion translate into political activism, though? I mean, I guess that's the question.
There's always that potential, but I just think that we have to wait and see what happens. We just have to see how all of this evolves after all of the dust settles. I do want to get back to an earlier point about whether this has been a tipping point. I understand and agree that the getting legislation done is going to be very, very difficult on a national level, because everybody goes to their respective corners. But I also think that there is an emotional component here, and that is that the population, people in general across the country, are feeling very, very vulnerable, feeling very alone. No one is taking care of this issue. No one. People are just holding their breath, waiting for a possible next a shootout or slaughter. And I think that's making people in general highly uncomfortable.
Daryl, let me just bring you back on the conversation. Your thoughts there. Does this kind of resonate? I mean, you touched on some of those issues in your column, and I should point out, too, that you talk about the fact that the nightclub shooting kind of hit close to home. Your daughter had been to that club a couple of times. She knew the club. So this is beyond just, something that you might have read about but had no personal connection with.
Yeah, it really does resonate. That did bring it home, as you pointed out. My daughter was a University of Central Florida student and a musical theater major, and a lot of her friends were gay, and she joined them at that club almost a half dozen times. And the time when I got the news of the shooting, you know, certainly one of the first things I did was to reach out to her to make sure she was okay. And you just never know when your last moment can be. And I mean, she could have made a decision that night to go to Pulse, and we'd be having a totally different conversation with me this morning.
Mm-hmm. Daryl Owens there, also joined by Jason Garcia and Maria Padilla in the studio. I want to talk now about the money that's coming into Orlando. We heard from a caller before talking about the kind of overwhelming level of support that's coming in for the victims, the families, everybody affected by this. Some $9 million and counting for the One Orlando Fund. The City Beautiful is not the only place, of course, to face a mass casualty, whether it's a mass shooting, a disaster on a big scale. But suddenly it's found itself trying to figure out how to help people who have big expenses, pay for hotel bills, car retitlements, funerals, travel. Well, are you concerned about where your donations are going as you dig into your wallet to help the Pulse nightclub shooting victims? We're at 1-866-338-5252. So talk a little bit about the police response. There are questions about that. Nobody's questioning the heroism of the police who responded, helped rescue those folks during that long and grueling standoff and what was obviously a terrible, unprecedented situation at the nightclub. But there are questions about the timeline. The police have been fielding those questions, and the FBI too. 1-866-338-5252. Let's talk about that $9 million first, though. Here's Buddy Dyer, Orlando mayor, talking about what they're going to do with that money.
We are going to give the money directly to the victims. Alex Martins is heading up a group of 11 individuals that make up the committee that's going to figure out how to go about accomplishing that. The gentleman that ran the New York Fund and the Boston Fund is consulting with us and assisting us in figuring out exactly how to do that. But that will be measured in days and not months in terms of being able to make those funds available.
Well, that crisis went way beyond those directly affected by the nightclub shooting. Here is Carlos Cifuentes. He owns a barbershop across the street from Pulse. His business was closed for 8 days. Investigators looked for evidence at the crime scene during that time.
It's pretty bad. It's not that great, you know. You lose part of your income, you know. So, you know, income, salaries, the barbers, you know. We have bills to pay, you know.
So some obviously some big expenses from some of the folks involved in this tragedy, whether tangentially or directly involved. 1-866-338-5252. Maria Padilla, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, this is a big pot of money, and the county officials, city officials have to figure out how to handle it. What's your kind of take on how Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer and his team there are doing?
Well, I applauded Mayor Dyer's position to funnel the money directly to the victims. I think that's the right thing to do. And I also applaud that he brought in the person from the Boston Marathon shootings. I believe his last name is Feinberg, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, yeah.
To help actually disperse the money, the funds, to the families and the survivors and so forth, and to get it done as quickly as possible. So I think they're on the right track there. Get this done, get it out, help people in real time, not wait 2, 3, or 4, or 5 months, because the bills are today, medical bills, funeral bills, travel bills, as you stated. So I kind of like that idea.
Mm-hmm. Jason Garcia, there will be questions. I mean, this is going to take a long time to get this money. Well, actually, Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer, and this is per the advice of the gentleman Maria mentioned, the advice is to get that money out, distributed as quickly as possible, but there will be ongoing expenses and there will be scrutiny on the city how it deals with this. I mean, this is kind of unprecedented for the city. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it is something the city's never dealt with, but one of the things that will be incumbent upon the city and then the state as well is to look at other places that have dealt with this and learn from the mistakes that they've made, and bringing in the gentleman who had worked on the Boston Marathon stuff, that's a great step towards that. Someone who has seen some process like this, because when there's this much money involved, things can go wrong, even unintentionally. So it will be vitally important that they make sure that they look at how other communities have dealt with this same stuff and they avoid making some of the same mistakes that have been made in the past.
Mm-hmm. Kenneth Feinberg told us that it is important. This is the gentleman who was in charge of the 9/11 funds, the Boston Marathon compensation bombing compensation funds, et cetera. He said it's basically pretty important to get the money out as quickly as possible, but expect some bumps in the road. Expect people to have some questions there for the way things go ahead. And I think already you're seeing, examples. Maybe I read a story of somebody who said he was at the nightclub when the shooting happened. Turned out that there are some questions about that. Maybe people trying to profit off selling T-shirts, everything else. I mean, it's a tricky situation. In an event like this, people want to open their wallets and their hearts, right? So how do you kind of navigate that? What are your thoughts, Maria?
I think it's very difficult to navigate that because, unfortunately, there is always the dark side of human character or personality that emerge to take advantage of situations like this. And I believe that Feinberg is correct that not everybody is going to be happy, because one of the first things you have to do for dispersing the funds is to impose some criteria. Who gets it? Why? Were mm-hmm. you there? Do you have proof? And that alone is going to make some people quite unhappy. So, yes, it's going to be a contentious process, but one that I think has to be very strictly followed.
I want to turn now and just talk briefly about the timeline of the shooting, the actual shooting on the early morning of that Sunday, as the shots rang out, as police responded, the SWAT team waited and then burst into that nightclub to rescue the hostages. Just concerns, maybe some questions about what damage it could do to the city to hold on to the 911 recordings, which a bunch of media outlets are now trying to get their hands on. The city saying, well, it's an active investigation. We need to take direction from the FBI here. Jason Garcia, police and other agencies warn against second-guessing, but how much information is the public entitled to?
Oh, second-guessing is incredibly important in these situations. That's how you learn, and that's how, if there were mistakes made, people need to know about what they were so they aren't made again. And there are lots of questions in terms of the tactical response here. I think the Washington Post talked to a police officer who said there was a small group of officers that got in the club almost immediately and then were instructed to wait for 15 to 20 minutes, maybe more, rather than going right after the shooter. There may be very important and valid reasons for that, but they need to be aired. And that's why releasing these records, releasing 911 calls, releasing police radio traffic, all that is important so people can see what was done, why it was done, and what could have done better. Second guessing, I think there's a tendency in law enforcement and probably in lots of different groups, but to sort of band ranks and treat any criticism as a sort of everyone against us. But in this sort of thing, criticism is important and second guessing is crucial. This has to be looked at very closely and studied. So the next time this happens, because it will happen again somewhere, that people can respond more effectively.
Mm. Darrell Owens, police departments across the country have come under the microscope in the last couple of years. I wonder how you see this investigation playing out for the Orlando Police Department.
Well, I kind of echo what Jason says. Certainly in the aftermath of this shooting, this investigation will come under close scrutiny from all quarters, and how OPD responded will become a paragon for the next inevitable mass shooting of what works and what doesn't work. And while OPD has been praised for its efforts and heroism, legitimate questions about protocols, decision-making, and leadership do demand answers.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to a little bit more about the timeline there. Maria Padilla, mass shootings generate a lot of discussion about motives and the like. I'm wondering what it does for the narrative about this shooting for Orlando to drag its feet on releasing 911 and other recordings from that night.
Well, I think what happens is that the longer you take, the more it sort of raises a cloud of suspicion over why is taking so long? Is there something that they're hiding? Is there something that went wrong that they don't want people to know? As a reporter, I know that my eyes went directly to that three-hour gap between the 202 shooting, as far as we know so far, mm-hmm. and the 5 a.m. or thereafter, charging of the club. Yep. By the police. And that was my very first thought. What happened in those 3 hours? Well, we know that it was perhaps a hostage situation, but what else happened that took so long? And I think that's a question that's going to be raised over and over again and that has to be directly answered.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Still to come, we're going to take a little slight change of tack here, talk about bears. They get a respite from the hunt this year. We'll also come back to the Pulse shooting. How does it play into the fears of tourists, if any, in the City Beautiful? We're taking your calls when Intersection returns.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Aggressive Appliances, a family-owned company that has been selling, installing, and servicing appliances in Central Florida for 35 years. Aggressive Appliances specializes in luxury brands and features galleries of live working kitchens. Learn more at aggressiveappliances.com. Aggressive Appliances, a deeper commitment to appliances and the people who love them.
Good morning. Nice to have you with us. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. You can check in with us throughout the day on our website at WMFE.org. We're also on Twitter at WMFE Orlando.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Rollins College. The demand for qualified healthcare managers and administrators is growing rapidly, particularly in Central Florida. To help meet this need, Rollins College offers degrees in healthcare management, health service administration, and public health. Learn more at rollins.edu/evening.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Jason Garcia and Maria Padilla. Joining us by phone, Daryl Owens. You can join the conversation too. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Well, on WMFE this week, we heard from some Brazilian tourists talking about how shaken they are by the shooting at Pulse nightclub. Brazil is a pretty colossal market for Orlando's tourism industry. There's also that alligator attack at Disney. A toddler drowned after being snatched from a lakeshore by an alligator. Now, the FWC says it's pretty confident it got the offending gator, but a week of terrible news for Orlando. I'm wondering whether a 1-2 punch of a gator attack, a mass shooting, could cast a chill over what the happiest place on earth. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Jason Garcia, realistically, what kind of impact do you see the Pulse shooting having on tourism, if at all, on the area theme parks?
Well, that's obviously sort of the million-dollar question for Orlando's economy. I think my instinct is that it will not have much of a long-term effect, only because I think the fact that it did not happen in a tourist area, and I think there's enough of a sort of consumer awareness that Disney World – that it did not happen at Disney World. And then you layer in Disney's – nobody markets as well as Disney that I think that they will, you know, if there might be a short term blip, but I don't think there's any sort of long term impact. But the sort of cumulative effect of these things happening and people potentially becoming more afraid of going to places where there are lots of people, I think that's a serious long term threat for Orlando that they need to deal with. I think psychologically, there's a chance more and more consumers can decide, you know, it is not worth going to places that seem like obvious targets for madmen or terrorists. Mm-hmm. That's a much longer term thing, and I don't know exactly how you address it head on, but I think that's something that Disney and Universal and all the smart minds are probably thinking about right now.
Is that a practical consideration, or is it a marketing question? Because, you know, last year, right after, I believe it was in December, if I remember correctly, you know, we saw extra screening going in at all three big theme parks in Orlando. Could we see some more of that, perhaps?
I expect you will, yeah. For a long time, one of the balances the theme parks have tried to do is you want to be secure, but you don't want to make people sort of – you don't want to ruin the illusion that you're in a sort of a fantasy place. But I think things are shifting to the point where people are expecting that, and they're going to have to be doing more of that so people feel comfortable that when they go inside, they won't be a target. I would expect over the next few years – theme parks, especially the entrances, to become more and more like airports, frankly. I think that's something consumers will come to expect.
I'm wondering how that plays out in reality, though, because, you know, you think about Disney, they do a pretty great job of getting huge numbers of people through their turnstiles in a pretty short order. That's kind of an engineering challenge in some respects. If you add in more layers of security, how do you get around that? Make sure that people don't spend 2 hours queuing up just to get into the park and sweltering in the sun.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's an enormous engineering challenge, and Disney has thousands of industrial engineers on its payroll. I imagine looking at just this sort of thing. You know, there was a time that, you know, you couldn't have imagined 20 years ago the number of Disney tourists coming now, them getting through sort of turnstiles, but they got rid of turnstiles. Right now, people walk in with an RFID chip. So, I mean, you can use technology to speed some of these processes, but yeah, that's the challenge, right? You want to do thorough security, but you also don't want to be an airport where people are waiting 2 hours to get through security. Mm-hmm. But you know, these are some of the smartest crowd control minds in the world. So if anyone can figure some of that sort of logistical stuff out, they can.
Daryl Owens, let me just bring you in this conversation. I want to come back to what you wrote about in your column, that sort of sense of numbness and, that kind of feeling, I guess, of helplessness after the shooting. Do you get the sense that this tarnishes Orlando with the brush of being a dangerous place to visit, or are visitors able to make that separation? As Jason said, obviously this didn't happen anywhere near Disney, but it's Orlando nonetheless.
Well, Matthew, let me put it this way. 56 people were shot and killed in separate incidents in Chicago during Father's Day weekend, which tragically is par for the course for the Windy City. And yet the Windy City's charms blew in more domestic tourists to visit in 2015 than any year before. But closer to home, in 1993, there were British tourists were being robbed and killed on Florida's highways. And when unnerved vacationers started canceling their Florida travel plans, Governor Lawton Childs beefed up enforcement at all the interstate highway rest areas across Florida. Problem solved. So I figure similarly, this too shall pass.
Maria Padilla, to that end, if we come back to the issue of guns for a moment, if lawmakers want to get some movement on gun control bills, background checks, some other kind of measures that some are pushing for, what kind of role, if any, could the theme park lobby play in that?
I think one of the things that the shooting has clarified for a lot of the theme parks is that they are, in fact, part of the community. No matter how much you try to draw that circle around your property and around the tourism, and this is a magical separate place from Orlando, the fact of the matter is that in the last 2 weeks or so, we haven't heard Orlando's name mentioned in connection with wonderful tourism, but we've heard Orlando shooting, Orlando shooting, Orlando shooting. That tends to harm the tourism market for not just Orlando, but all of Florida. So to that end, I would think that perhaps in a quiet way, the tourism industry, the theme park lobbyists or industry may have to quietly push to get that off of the headline and maybe try to get some sense into the situation, because they are directly affected by all of this.
And to your point there, I mean, if you look at some of those memorials, there's one I took a look at this week, one of those crosses there in front of RMC, there's a young man who worked as a ride attendant. So, yes. This is pretty tied in. Also, we've seen, big amounts of money coming into the One Orlando Fund from the theme park businesses. So they are, as you say, kind of pretty well entwined.
Very much entwined. Disney, I think, donated $1 million to one Orlando fund.
Let me come back to the alligator, Jason. This gator attack, people were focused on Pulse, of course, because of the magnitude of that tragedy. But then you had this young toddler, two-year-old, I believe, snatched from his family, right on the shores of a lake. And this happened right on Disney property. What could be the impact of that, if any?
In terms of tourism?
Indeed.
Yeah, I don't think that has any impact on tourism. It's sort of a freakish event, and it's not the sort of thing that I think people will be afraid of happening to them. It's this idea that sort of the Pulse shooting and the alligator attack sort of constitute sort of two sort of bad things happening to Orlando tourism. I think that's false. They're clearly very different. I don't think there'll be any impact business, tourism-wise, traffic-wise, to the theme parks from the alligator attack. It's just a horrific sort of lightning strike-like event.
Well, let's talk about bears for a moment. Bears get a reprieve, the Florida black bears. The Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission decides there won't be a hunt this year, maintains that hunting is a key part of the array of bear management tools. For those of you out there protesting the bear hunt last year and taking part in marches and protests this year, do you feel like this is a vindication? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Jason, back to you. What kind of behind-the-scenes pressure could there have been on the FWC to can the hunt this year? I'm kind of wondering, if the fact that it's an election year, that could have been weighing on these commissioners or the governor.
I think that had a big role in this. Generally speaking, the commentary for these bear hunts has been the public comment has been overwhelmingly negative. I think it's not something they wanted to do before this election. If they do it again, it'll be after the elections. They'll set one in an off year.
Maria Padilla, are these bear hunt protesters, do you think, are going to look at this and say, we won, so what are we going for next? I wonder if this is kind of going to embolden the environmental movement.
Sure. The environmental movement in Florida does have a high profile, so I would imagine that they will use this in some way, shape, or form. But I think it was also a good idea to postpone it because it would have been a bit too gruesome coming so shortly after the shootings to see another spectacle of bear shootings in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Daryl Owens, we've heard plenty of arguments from pro-hunt groups who say the bears are worse than a nuisance. They're harming humans and pets. There are also those who say the answer is to keep your garbage locked up. Given the political toxicity of the bear hunt, do you think we'll see more state funding or maybe more emphasis on non-lethal bear control methods?
I would love to think so, but I'm skeptical because of the legislative inertia that has existed the past several years on the bear issue. Across the country, other state assemblies have at least proposed measures to mandate the use of non-lethal methods, but so far the Sunshine State hasn't really stepped up to the plate.
What about in your neighborhood? Because you get a few bears kind of passing through right close by your backyard. Are people stepping up and locking up their garbage or doing whatever they have to make sure those bears aren't foraging in the trash?
Well, we haven't done it as a collective body through the Homeowners Association or anything like that, but in just my general observation, I see that my neighbors wait until the morning to bring their trash from the garage, and I haven't really seen any loose refuse around the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Jason, just coming back to you, there are a bunch of local governments calling time out on the hunt. You know, these measures were symbolic, but I'm wondering if you get the sense that either the FWC or the governor's office pays a lot of attention to them. You know, could they have some influence on that decision to take the hunt off the table this year?
Yeah, I think the local governments are reflective of what their communities are hearing. So in the sense that these are sort of windows into sort of the broader electorate, yeah, I do think they pay attention to that. And I do think the more local governments coming out against things, that does have an impact on what the state does.
Mm-hmm. There's at least one candidate for state office this year who's hitching his wagon to the anti-bear hunt movement. How does this move from the FWC give him some momentum or do the opposite, since it's no longer, you know, something that hunt opponents really have to worry about, at least for now?
Well, I don't think it's not something they have to worry about sort of in the very near-term future, but it's not going away as an issue. My inclination is if your sort of calling card is you're an activist who's been fighting this is good for you. You can prove how effective you've been. So I think I think it's a good thing for him. I don't know that that's enough to carry a candidacy by any stretch, but mm-hmm. but it's, you know, you'd certainly rather win than lose.
I guess it depends on where you live, right? If you're in a neighborhood where there have been bear attacks, or maybe if you saw some bears being shot during that hunt, you might have a pretty, you know, that might be the most important thing that you see going forward into this election.
Sure, absolutely. But I suspect even in those neighborhoods, I don't see the bear hunt or bear nuisance as being sort of a driving issue this election.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, before we close out on Intersection this week, I want to talk about some poll numbers. The presumptive nominees for their respective political parties in the presidential primary, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton. According to the latest Q poll, Clinton has an 8-point lead over Trump in Florida. Just how reliable are those polls, though? And where does Bernie Sanders fit into this picture? Maria Padilla, should Trump supporters be worried about Clinton opening up a lead in the polls over the summer?
I think they are worried. I think that's why they have sort of tried to, the party in particular has tried to really kind of draw the wagons around the candidate and give him a little bit of schooling in terms of how to campaign for a general election. That's why he fired his campaign manager and so on and so forth. So I think they're a little bit worried. But keep in mind that we're still a little bit out from the general election, and things can easily change. And so there will be more polls, and folks will go up and they will go down. But, yeah, I think that the GOP has tried very, very hard to try to kind of tame Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. And we're seeing Donald Trump jumping in and saying Brexit, which happened last night, UK voting to leave the European Union. He's saying, like, look, this is a sign that people, my supporters back in the United States, are saying, well, we want to do the same thing, essentially.
One thing I was just going to add to with this election, one thing to keep in mind is polling is going to be very difficult. Donald Trump is going to be bringing out a whole bunch of people, it looks like, mm-hmm. that wouldn't normally vote, at the same time turning off a whole lot of people that normally vote. Polling, capturing sort of this new electorate, but also accounting for folks that, that sort of you would normally think of as reliable Republican voters who aren't going to vote. I don't know that the polling is it's going to be very tricky to sort of read anything else, particularly this far out.
Mm-hmm. In the last 30 seconds or so, Jason, though, how does Bernie Sanders factor into this? Because he's saying he'll vote for Hillary Clinton. He's not dropping out of the race, though. What's he doing?
You know, he says he's angling he wants to make sure the Democratic platform takes on some of his issues, minimum wage, Citizens United, that sort of thing. I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is it's very hard to sort of to say it's over when you've sort of come this far. You know, mm-hmm. I think when you look at where that his campaign started to where it sort of grew to, I think it's difficult to sort of finally end it.
Jason Garcia is an associate editor of Florida Trend magazine. Thank you so much for coming in, Jason.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm also joined by Daryl Owens. He's the communications director at Beacon College, also a columnist for FloridaPolitics.com. Thank you so much, Daryl.
Glad to participate. Thank you.
And Maria Padilla, editor of the Orlando Latino blog. Find that at orlandolatino.org. Thank you so much, Maria.
Great being here.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistant for today's show from Nicole Creston and Adam Mano. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.